Welcome to Credits Due, the podcast where we break down an actor's filmography one movie at a time. I'm Ben Cron, and joining me today is Tyler Owen.
I'm going to join the army and flunk out.
And Neil Potter.
I would not advise that because I hear they hunt you down if you haven't paid, like if you're going to college and you are there paying for your college and then you drop out. They're like, hey, give me that money back, you fool.
Oh, well, that, there goes that plan.
Even though you've graduated college.
Yeah. Also, the GI Bill is apparently going through some rough shit right now. So.
Yeah.
So that concludes our military talk. Let's get into the show, guys. We're on part five on our series on Julianne Moore, and today we are talking about the 1998 remake Psycho. This is, of course, the remake of the amazing Hitchcock film. It's directed by Gus Van Sant. It stars Vince Vaughn, Anne Heche, and Julianne Moore. It's about a young, according to IMDb, this is an incredible little plot synopsis right here. A young female embezzler arrives at the Bates Motel, which has terrible secrets of its own.
Yes, nailed it. That's accurate.
That is accurate. And of course, we'll, as always, we'll start with some film trivia. Then we'll dive into our full spoiler-filled discussion on the movie Psycho. And we'll finish with some final thoughts on Julianne Moore and then some recommendations. So, Tyler, you want to kick us off with some film trivia?
Yeah, can I just say what a great word embezzler is? Doesn't that just sound like something that like Dr. Seuss made up or something? I love it.
Yeah, it kind of is.
All right. Yeah, so every episode I give four bits of trivia related to our main movie of discussion, and I make up one of them, and you guys have to try and figure out which one it is. So for today, we have number one. The psychiatrist's long-winded description of Norman's condition was actually shortened in this version compared to the original. Number two, when asked why he did a shot-for-shot full-color remake, Gus Van Sant replied, no one else would have to. Number three.
What a trooper. Spoiler alert, no one had to, Gus. No one had to.
Number three, Quentin Tarantino is a huge fan of this film, even admitting he prefers this version over the Alfred Hitchcock classic.
Of course.
And number four, Julianne Moore described the film later as a, quote, ill-begotten picture made with insincere reverence, adding also that, quote, in retrospect, the invention of the masturbation scene was symbolic of the production itself. All right. Who wants to guess first which one is the fake?
I will. I'm going to say the Quentin Tarantino one because I don't want to believe that that is true.
Oh, my God. I totally believe that that's true just because that's a totally Tarantino thing to say.
Yeah. Hold out hope.
I really want the last one to be true as well about the vicious Julianne Moore slam. So I guess I'm gonna do the first one about the quote being shortened, because okay. No reason.
Well, I swept you both.
Shoot.
the Julianne Moore quote was incorrect. The only part of that is that's true is that actor William H. Macy described the film as an ill-begotten picture. That was his only thing to say on the matter. He was actually still pretty proud of his performance, but did not seem to agree with the way that the film as a whole was created. So, but yeah, Quentin Tarantino says that this is his favorite version of the film.
Oh, Jesus.
Damn it.
My God. Quentin.
and yes, Gus Van Sant's quote seems to show no amount of self-awareness. So, So no one else would have to.
Oh, God.
Oh, that's so funny. So, guys, let's dive into this movie, and I say we just kind of go in chronological order and just go through each act of this movie. And yeah, just starting with the first act. This first part of the movie follows Anne Heche and her character of Marion Crane, and I think we talked about this on the last episode, but maybe let's put on the record again. Who's seen the original?
I have not.
In watching this version, I've seen the last half hour of the original that I know for sure I have.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Okay. Oh, wow. So I've seen all of it. It's been a while. I definitely completely forgot about the William H. Macy's character, the private detective. Mm. But I mean, this first part with Anne Heche, this is the iconic part. And I would say I was full on into this movie during basically leading up to her death. I really enjoyed it. I thought, I mean, it's exactly like the original. So it's hard to be like, oh yeah, the tension was so incredible. It's great how they, you know, build everything up. But it, to my memory, it's exactly the same.
So you like the part of this that Julianne Moore is not in at all?
Yes. And also, when watching this version, I was like, and I'm interested to see what you guys thought of it, but I wonder if this is actually a good movie or just the twist makes it a like film nerd movie, that it's like setting up all these stakes for this character all at the beginning and setting up all these clues of like that people are like her embezzling, and then like all these clues of people like kind of noticing that she's kind of on the run and hiding from someone. And then it's like 45 minutes in, she's dead. And then it becomes like all of that is just basically nothing. It becomes like just a footnote in all the other characters who, aside from Viggo, the boyfriend, who's played by Viggo Mortensen, are like all new characters. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if it's just like, I wonder if I just like the twist on how it really plays, like, it plays against, screenwriting rules.
Right. I think there's, so I will just say that I'm sure that the original is great. I feel like I can see that DNA in this one, and I can understand why it's so beloved. And I feel like the only reason I can judge that is because this one I've heard from so many accounts is so similar. But mm-hmm. I also feel like there's a huge amount of leeway that you give to an older film when you're watching it, because so much changes just in the language of how we tell stories on film in just even a decade or so. And so the, like, applying a 1960s script to modern filmmaking was just horribly off-putting for me. I could not get into this from the start.
This movie did absolutely nothing for me. I am in full agreement with that. Like, the movie just doesn't scale. It doesn't time scale. I don't think it worked throwing that in a I don't even really want to call it a modern setting, but like putting it, I don't want to say just putting it in color, but something about this just didn't feel right. I don't, and that's the
no, old, yeah.
Oh, I think it's easily, I mean, new cameras and color, I think really, the tricks that they use in this movie that in 1960 were like, they had to do it because of limitations, but in this one, it's not limitations. It's a style decision that they choose. And I agree with you. It doesn't work at all.
Yeah. And just even like camera angles and stuff where it's like, that's not really a limitation of the technology in the 60s. It was just, that was just the style of Alfred Hitchcock and the style of the time. And we've just come so far. Like it reminds me of like how terrible those like flash zooms were in like the 80s, right? Like when you like zoom in on someone's reaction from a really long ways away and it just looks so bizarre today. Like that's the same kind of feeling I had with several of the shots in this film. They weren't as egregious as an example of that, I don't think, but like there are fads that happen. They like types of shots and types of cinematography fall in and out of fashion. And it was just so like the contrast was so stark between like I had to constantly remind myself, like, I'm watching a movie with Vince Vaughn in it. Like,
yeah, right?
This is a movie that was made in my lifetime, but it sounds like everyone here is like a time traveler. It's so bizarre.
And you could even tell in the techniques. Now, I get that this is like a shot for shot remake, but maybe something that using actors that we are us and our age group are familiar with, like color, this and that, like having like a shot of when that actor's talking, they're on camera. And then when the other actor's talking, they're on camera. It's not like it's very cut and dry. And obviously that was like a thing of its time, but it just felt wrong
So there were a few opinions online that I was reading during the research for trivia that I'm really curious if you want to give this much credit to the filmmaker, but there is a theory that Gus Van Sant did this on purpose and he just picked Psycho as his topic for this experiment. Basically, it could have been any movie, but his idea was theoretically that he wanted to demonstrate how like just making something shot for shot identical will not result with the same feel. And like, I don't know if I want to give him that much credit.
Too much credit.
Like I want to say that I feel like his experiment was the reverse, that he was trying to prove that the filmmaking was so incredible back then that he could basically just do the same thing and it would be just as good. And I think that fails horribly.
I would agree.
And there's so much, because Danny Elfman did the score for this movie, and I think it's exactly the same. Mm-hmm. I think there's very few changes to the original score.
I think all they did was like adapt it into stereo.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I actually have a note on the score specifically. Obviously, Danny Elfman did just a fine job. It's like one of the movies that you couldn't tell it was Danny Elfman doing the soundtrack to it. But
yes.
One thing that went through my mind as I was watching this is that the soundtrack, as like iconic as it is exhausting to listen to. Like, I don't know how you felt, but like just her driving in the car and all you hear is this really sharp strings just going and going and going for quite a while. Mm-hmm. It's just like it's exhausting to listen to. Like, it's because it's like there's no I don't know. Maybe people have found
that is something that didn't age well either. Yeah. Like in the original, like that's just kind of how old movies were.
Yeah,
like
there's no subtlety to it. Yeah. You know, it's all just like way over the top. And, but I mean, I feel like I could have enjoyed that in the context of a 1960s film, right? Like, and right. I want to go back and watch the original now and see how much of a difference it has on me.
Yeah, I'm really interested in how you guys, because how you guys would think of the watching the original, because I did, because it's a movie that I love, and I think I really enjoyed this, the first half of this movie, I think just because nostalgia. Like, I was just like seeing something that I already knew and I already liked, and it that just took me, that just, it, that enjoyment lasted for me for a while. And it wasn't until, the death scene, the shower scene, that that scene in this movie was the first time I was like, oh, okay, this doesn't work in like 1998. Like, 'cause I just thought that, you know, that I'm sure you guys have seen the original, just like, I mean, that whole death scene is shown so many times.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure you guys have seen it somewhere, but like, that's such an iconic moment. And in this one, I believe it's exactly the same. And it just did not work for me. Like, I was just like, okay.
It's almost like, laughable about how, I guess, looking at it at this sense, it's laughable at how bad it looks, almost, in my opinion.
Yeah.
But and obviously that's just because of what we're used to, like, but I...
Well, I think the association goes further than that, though, because I think part of the reason why we perceive it as looking bad now is not because it's not because the original is bad. It's because every iteration of that thing after the original is done as like an over the top, like pop culture reference.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So any modernization of the original is done in a way that you're like intended to laugh at it. And here we have them basically doing the same thing as a parody, but with all seriousness, right? Like there's no attempt to like change that perception of the other hundreds of times that scene has been parodied. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I don't think they're aware of, I don't think they're aware of how it would look in like a modernized, like a movie for their time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, like the quote you said, I don't know if you made it up, but about the masturbation scene.
Yeah.
About how it was like that was emblematic of the movie.
That was
like,
actually Roger Ebert said something to that effect. He's like, it's funny that one of the only scenes they added was a masturbation scene, which seems to be emblematic of the production or something like that.
It seemed very much like, it's like, hey, guys, we're making a Hitchcock movie. Like, how cool is it that we're making a Hitchcock movie, but they didn't like that's all it was. Like this movie felt very soulless.
Oh, so I just thought of like a perfect example of what I'm talking about with that parody effect. So are you guys familiar with the SNL sketch of Casablanca with Kate McKinnon as the female actress playing that role from that film? It's like a redone version of the ending sequence of Casablanca, and go look it up. It's absolutely hilarious, but it is exactly what I'm talking about. It's like, it's filmed in color and amazing HD cameras, but it's exactly the same scene. But then they just, you know, they obviously changed the dialogue to make it funny, but that's what this whole movie felt like, but without the jokes. And it's just like, it's bringing to mind that like SNL effect of when something is parodied with modern technology and actors. Yeah. And so it just, yeah, that was the sticking point for me. I couldn't get past it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in the same boat.
Mm.
I'm getting too ahead of myself here, but I just want to touch on that, masturbatory line or whatever and about that scene that they added in specifically for that, I felt like even adding that scene was not even like was a pointless addition. Because it's not like he needs to be made out to be any creepier than he already is. Like, I felt like that was like the 90s. Like, it's the 90s now. People jerk off and look through a little keyhole to like naked chicks.
It's not even just that. Like, it almost feels, having never seen the original, I feel like I can say that it seems a counter to the character. Like,
exactly. Yeah.
I think part of what makes him scary is that he's this innocent, like, boy, you know, mm-hmm. who's been trapped in this weird world by his mother. And, like, it doesn't feel right that he's expressing himself sexually with that direct of an expression,
yeah.
right? Like,
yeah.
It seems like something where he would, like, get angry at himself for even thinking about her being nude or something like that, much less actually, like, spy on her and jerk off.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So
it's very strange because, like, it's because the movie tries to hide that he is the killer.
Mm-hmm.
And they want to make you think that the mother is doing the killing. And so, like, him spying on a woman showering herself and, like, him jerking off, it just, like, makes his creep factor go up, which there's, like, the only there's no other signs of him being a creep except just, like, his demeanor. Like, he has this weird giggle.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, and that's not even, like, creepy at all.
Yeah.
So what did you guys think of Vince Vaughn? I have a feeling I already know the answer to that, so I will.
What? Honestly,
I will read from.
Go
I
for
will,
it. Okay. Okay.
Wait. First, let me read my note that I have on Vince Vaughn, and then I'll let you guys okay. go off. Here's what I wrote down while watching this movie. Oh shit! Vince Vaughn is so good.
Is that it?
That's it. I really liked him in this movie. I thought he was really good.
I assumed you were going in the other direction there, and I was gonna be like, well, actually, I didn't think he was half bad. I think that he does come off creepy. I think his demeanor and, like, that, like, giggle thing he does, like, I think that worked. Yeah. Like, and he kind of came off with, like, this infant, like, or childlike mind type thing. And I think mm-hmm. Vince Vaughn has this, like, his, like, speech that he usually is, like, is very quick and, like, to the point kind of a thing. Or, like, it's he's a fast talker, but he might ramble. But it's, like, mm-hmm. I don't know. Like, it's just the way he speaks in this. And I've seen him do it in, like, other films. It's kind of like this, the way he does things. But, like, I felt like it.
Wedding Crashers was really that, I think, when he almost, like, improv, like, style of dialogue.
I felt like that kind of worked for his character, who was kind of loosey-goosey, up in the head kind of a thing. So, like, I would say he was one of the he was a completely fine part of the film. I don't think he did a terrible job at all.
Yeah, I think the main emotion I had watching him on screen was that of pity. Like, I felt bad for him almost. I think maybe there's a good performance in there, and it just sucks that he's being filmed in this way, mm-hmm. or that he's having to deal with this script and this dialogue that doesn't fit the modern world we live in. Like, it just felt so unfortunate. Like, I almost want to see this alternate reality where someone made a halfway passable good version of this remake with him as mm-hmm. Norman Bates, because I think he could have pulled it off. I'm not going to say, like, it'd definitely be one of those instances where, like, even if people say they like it, they'd still never say it was ever as good as the original. Mm-hmm. Like, there's just not a reality where that happens. But I think that he could have had this as, like, one of his films in his career that like really kicked it off, right? Mm-hmm. But it's as far as I know, like no one references his role in this movie, you know?
Oh yeah. Aside only because like it's weird. It's a very weird role for him, especially looking at like all the comedies he does now.
Right. But I mean, if you look back at his other films he was doing around this time, this could have set a totally different trajectory for his career if it succeeded, right?
Yeah.
And that's what I find interesting, because it's like every instinct I had to laugh at his performance was only because it's only because of the knowledge I have of his career after this point, right? Mm-hmm. So I felt like I was doing him a disservice with my own bias going into it, and it had nothing to do with his performance.
I thought it was inspired casting. I think he's obviously very good at a dramatic role and playing this creep. But also he can offset that just from his comedy instincts. Mm-hmm. It makes it a very fun character to watch. I thought he was absolutely incredible in this movie. I did not pity him at all. The actors that I did pity in this movie, literally everyone else. So what I will say, Anne Heche, I thought was really incredible too. I thought she did a great job playing this role.
Yeah, I felt like she did. Yeah, solid.
Once she dies, though, like I think either just the like veil broke for me of like what this movie actually is, or it possibly that the quality of the movie just went downhill after that, because William H. Macy gets introduced, who I think does a fine job as in this very small role. Julianne Moore is introduced, who I think this is a travesty that they gave her this role. I think she is underused, and like I understand looking at her career at the time, I understand why she would take this role, like only because like a remake of Psycho was probably very exciting at the time. Mm-hmm. But she's fine in this movie, and I think every good part that she is in, I think, is completely from her and not from the script or from the directing at all.
She is fine in this movie.
Yeah.
Her wardrobe is pretty on point.
this is like her Stone Cold Fox stage, as far as I'm concerned. I don't know. I still have a movie crush on her. So
as far as all these characters go, I'd say, from my point of view, the only people I feel like tried were Vince Vaughn and Anne Heche. Everyone else seemed like they were just phoning it in, to me anyway.
Yeah. Viggo Mortensen was pretty good. I kind of liked him as this like cowboy thing. Yeah.
But like again, nothing was distinguishing about him. It could have been anybody.
Yeah.
And that's the script, right? It's just no one else has character development except for is it Marcia Crane, whatever her name is,
Marion
Crane, and then a little bit with Norman Bates, and that's it. Like there's, after she dies, it's just like switches basically to having Norman as the protagonist almost, because it has that it has that effect, which I, you know, for the time that the original was made, I bet this was like groundbreaking stuff, right? To like have the audience start to empathize with, and not necessarily empathize, but like you have that gut feeling whenever someone's about to like try and catch him in or figure out that he was the killer, and you're like, oh no, he's gonna get caught. But like that's such a common thing now, but I'm betting at the time that was really, really unique, right?
Oh yeah. And I mean, so also, well, I think that's the genius of this story, is that the main character the supposed protagonist of the movie gets murdered, mm-hmm. and all of the like stakes that the movie has set up with that character are just like washed away, or dumped in a lake, and then you follow the protagonist. Norman Bates is basically the protagonist of this movie, but watching it the first time, you think that he's innocent, like, because he kills two people. He kills the detective later on, but it's all done in the sense that it's the mother killing both of them. Mm-hmm. So you think that he is also a victim, and yeah, in 1960 that was probably groundbreaking.
Yeah.
And the exposition, like, plot dump by the psychiatrist at the end.
Oh my God.
It was probably a big deal of being like, yeah, this dude's actually crazy and he killed all these people and his mother's been dead for a decade and he's just chilling with her dead body
It makes me wonder if this was like one of the first instances of a test audience rewrite, because like the story itself is totally comprehensible without that ending. And then people back there are just like, I have no idea what happened. What's going on? Who's that body? I'm just imagining like the groundbreaking nature of this film just blew people's minds so hard that the executives were just like, we gotta have somebody just lay it all out there. We just gotta have them tell everybody exactly what happened.
That's probably 100% true too.
I don't know. I mean, I imagine that's not the case because, think about
just
the
way
detective
things were done.
Trope.
Yeah. It's that Scooby-Doo thing, right? Like you pull off the mask at the end and explain exactly what happened. It was everything back then.
Yeah. Also, another thing about the original, I'm sure you guys have heard this, but Marion Crane, the actor, was like a big Hitchcock actress, and this was at the like height of her career, and all the promotional materials only showed her, and so every trailer, every poster, it was all her face. And then they didn't do Hitchcock refused he did not allow her and then the actor who played Norman Bates to do any press at all. And
see,
then
that shit's awesome.
Yeah.
I can totally see why this was such a big deal, but man. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so, yeah. So like it's like doing it now and then having Julianne Moore play Marion Crane.
Yeah.
Like having a huge actress, like, be in the first half hour and then die. Like, that's a huge deal. And then back then in the 60s, like, it probably never happened.
Right. You know what this kind of feels like? It feels like if like 20 years from now, somebody did a shot for shot remake of The Sixth Sense.
Yeah.
Like, that's true. You can't put that back in the box, right? Like, it's done. Mm. That aspect of the film is lost to time. Like, you can't undo the twist and have people experience it for the first time, especially when it's such a major part of pop culture. Mm-hmm. So that what you just described sounds incredible, but that's all lost on me, because the one thing I knew about this movie going in was that she dies in the shower. So you just can't get that same effect ever again.
Yeah. I mean, it's a lot. The closest thing we get now is putting Hulk in the Avengers Infinity War trailer.
Yeah.
You know, like at the end, that hero shot of them all running.
Yeah.
And it's like they put the Hulk in there and then it's like, no, he's actually
there,
did they also have the robot Hulk? Is like Hulkbuster?
Not in that same scene, that I don't think.
Yeah, I don't think so.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I remember, like, because there was a later trailer where it had the Hulkbuster and the Hulk. in it in different shots, but then everyone was just like, oh shit, Tony Stark's there, and he busted out this new, it's like, no, like the final movie, like no one knew. And then to keep talking about Avengers, I have not watched the Avengers Endgame trailer.
Oh yeah.
And I plan not to
watch any promo,
but there
material.
Was a part of me. Yeah, I'm going to try my hardest. It's going to be difficult. But there was a part of me that, because if you guys follow film news at all, like people have been freaking out that like it's December and we finally got a title of that movie, right? Mm-hmm. And people were freaking out just because they didn't know the title of the movie. And I kind of wanted Marvel just to do like a Mad Men thing where Mad Men for their like next time preview, they would show old footage of Mad Men. So you never saw like, you never saw footage from the next episode. Like I was kind of hoping that they'd just like release a trailer for Avengers Endgame. And it was all footage from Infinity War.
It was just a montage episode, like.
Yeah.
Well, I was watching I think it was like a YouTube video about like, or maybe it was just somebody talking about it, but it was like all the points in which like Marvel trailers have like, they've altered so much from the trailers to the actual film, like more than you even realize. Mm-hmm. Like there is scenes where like characters are completely different. Well, they did it with the Civil War too, where they had Spider-Man in some of those scenes and not in other, or like they didn't show their hand like right away. They've also done it with like minor details, like Thor's missing eye, like people's limbs and things like that. That are all like, it may or may not be true, so you can't always take the trailers as full truth, which is kind of awesome, actually.
There's also a trend recently of having like completely unique scenes function as the trailer, where it's like a sequence that's not in the film at all, but is just like a tone piece for what the movie is. And that's the kind of stuff I can really get behind too. So yeah, that's really fascinating that kind of stuff, that kind of promotional like innovation was happening with a movie like Psycho.
Yeah. Thanks for tying that one back, Tyler.
Let's get us back on track.
Yeah.
Segway.
I was worried we were lost. I was worried that we were going to talk Marvel for the next hour. Oh god. Jesus Christ. I honestly, is there anything else to say about Psycho? A few more notes. Viggo Mortensen is just a bad boyfriend. He seems to like have been pulled on this investigation.
Yeah.
Like, cause like until he gets to the hotel, he's basically just like, do we know that she's here? Like, do we know? Yeah. Like, he's just like constantly questioning everything. And it's like, dude, your girlfriend stole $400,000 and is missing.
But do we really have witnesses? Yes. But do they really know what they saw?
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. There's a lot of that.
Yeah.
Also, our second movie in a row that has a Flea cameo.
I was
going to
mention that. Yes.
Or no, actually. Wait, is he in Boogie Nights?
I don't recall.
No, he's not. Okay, so he's in The Big Lebowski, and then, yeah, he shows up as Viggo Mortensen's, like, employee.
Oh, yeah.
And, yeah, he has a good line. It's cool to see Flea.
Yep.
You know?
Which, God, there was there a Marilyn Manson song in the background, or was it Rob Zombie, I think?
Rob Zombie. That was weird.
That was another moment where I was like, what in the ever-living fuck is this movie? Like, I had no words.
That was one thing, because the song was Living Dead Girl, and I looked it up because it was one of those things that, like, I felt like I was watching a movie from the 60s, right?
Yeah.
And then
that comes
in. That song comes in, and I looked it up, and that movie came out in or that song came out in 1998, so the same year as this.
Jeez.
So that felt really like something that like we do now, where it's like, hey, Rob Zombie, like, what's your newest song? Like, I want to put it in my movie.
Yeah, that was the part. That really threw me up for a loop, because it was like, in my head, I was like, wait, this song is like way newer than even this movie, but it's not. Like, it's just,
yeah,
it's just that weird, like, it's like a optical illusion. I don't know.
I'm sure the lyrics to Living Dead Girl has a reference to Psycho in it or something like that.
Probably.
I'm sure it was just promotional synergy. That's how.
Yeah.
I mean,
but
movies have so many. They'll like get a hot artist to write a new song, and then it's like, this song will be on the radio, and then we can use it in the trailers, you know, and then like everyone will be happy when they see it.
That's just great. Like,
hacking psychology.
Living Dead Girl. Wham. Synergy at its finest.
Yeah. Well, okay. So we also haven't really discussed the fact that, like, Gus Van Sant is not a bad director. This seems like such a weird, out of left field thing. This was the year after he made Good Will Hunting and the year before he made Finding Forrester. Two, like, objectively pretty great movies. I just, that is so mind-boggling to me, because this is nothing like those movies.
Yeah. It's crazy. Like, it's so, like, looking at his IMDb page, Good Will Hunting was his first, like, big movie, right?
Yeah.
He has Drugstore Cowboy, which is a pretty good movie. Oh, shit. But that was in 1989? That was a full decade before this? Holy shit. Drugstore Cowboy is a great movie, but I don't know how it was received. If it was,
I've never seen it.
If he, and he only made a couple movies in between there. And then a lot of music videos.
Mm-hmm.
And then Good Will Hunting was like, I mean, it must have been a comeback. Like, that was a huge movie.
Yeah.
And it, I think it launched his career. And then, of course, it launched the screenwriting careers of one, Ben Affleck and
Matt Damon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And following that up with Psycho is crazy.
He needed something to fill the time in between that and Finding Forrester or whatever.
He also did not do a lot of movies. I mean, he did several movies right after that. And then he kind of goes quiet until he goes back to doing music videos. He does a one of the segments of Paris JTM. And then he comes back with Paranoid Park and then Milk, which were two huge movies.
Mm-hmm.
What a weird career he has.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of rare that you see someone go and do a film as large and as successful as Good Will Hunting and then go back to doing a bunch of music videos.
Yeah.
I feel like one of the only other people I can think of who's done that is Spike Jones.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, it might have been done on purpose, because I know Spike Jones does it just, well, I think he does his friends' music videos.
Right.
Yeah. It's weird shit.
Anyways, it just, the placement of this in his career seems just so bizarre. It's like, I wonder how much of this was like a passion project he actually cared about versus just something he wanted to see if he could get away with it, right?
Yeah. I honestly, it feels like when, like, what I feel like it is the parallel to now, is that this indie director does this movie, like, barely gets it financed. You know, it's written and stars, like, all unknowns. And it wins a bunch of Oscars. And then, like, now when that happens, they're like, all right, you're doing a superhero movie.
Direct to Star Wars.
Yeah, straight to Star Wars. Like, here's $10 million. Like, make this huge action movie. And it's like, well, wait, my last movie was about two college students. Like, and it's like, nope, you can do action now. Like, you got the budget.
Yeah.
You know, I bet, like, back then, it was just like, oh, you made this really popular movie and you got a bunch of awards. Like, do this remake that should never be done. Like, also, last note on Gus Van Sant, we should also not forget about his amazing cameo in the movie Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back, where where they go to Hollywood and they get on the set of Good Will Hunting 2.
He also has a cameo in this film where, I don't know if you noticed, when she walks into her workplace at the beginning, he is dressed as Alfred Hitchcock outside. Oh my God. And he is like, it looks like he's berating someone. And apparently that's the person he's berating is supposed to be him. And so it's supposed to be Alfred Hitchcock, like, basically saying, how dare you remake my movie?
Oh my God. So he knew he was making garbage this entire time.
Oh my God.
So Alfred Hitchcock is famous for doing cameos in all of his movies. Yeah. So in the original, was Alfred Hitchcock standing there? Was someone berating Alfred Hitchcock? Or was he berating?
He was doing the same thing, something like that. Or at least he was there in the same location.
Ugh, that just annoys me for some reason.
Yep.
All right. Anything else? Anything else on this movie?
No.
I don't have much more. I thought the opening credits were pretty good. Even though I think they were exactly the same. Like, I think they literally used the same credits. Like, the same, like, MOV file.
That could be.
You know, that 1960s flash drive with the...
Yeah. They edited it on Macs back then, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Oh, also, William H. Macy's death scene when he falls down the stairs and it's done, like, it's done in a green screen of him fake falling and then him superimposed on, like, stairs. That looked really bad.
Yeah, it looked like shit. Like,
that sucked that green screen of falling was right after one of the only truly terrifying scenes I thought in the whole movie, which was that super unique top down, I guess it would have been
of
Norman,
like, the
Bates
stairway.
Yeah. Top down of the stairway. He's at the very top and Norman Bates dressed as his mother comes storming out of that door. And she just like, he just takes like four long strides towards him with the knife and then you hear the slash sound and it cuts to his face. That was fucking cool. And I want to see that in the original because that was scary. And it was just because of the way that weird top down angle was so crazy.
Yeah. And I just don't know what it is. Cause that scene works in the original. And I don't know if it's just cause our brains are like, this is an old movie, so like we're okay with all this weird stuff. But yeah, this the death scenes in this movie are not great, and it's a huge bummer. Also, William H. Macy says, I think he says, if it don't gel, it ain't jello. Is that a saying?
Apparently, the script is identical.
Sounds like
so
a 60s thing to say.
Yeah,
that is Jell-O was brand new then. So,
I honestly, by the time it got about halfway through the movie, I was waiting for someone to come on screen and be like, "Yes, I'll have one milk, please." And then the cashier's like, "That'll be 5 cents, sir."
5 cents? This is outrageous.
Wait a minute. You don't get your milk delivered to your house like everyone else?
All right. Let's wrap this up. Let's put a knife in this and just end our misery.
Toss it in the lake.
Let's get to final thoughts. For every movie, we give Julianne Moore a rating of 1 to 5 Julians. So, Tyler, what are your final thoughts?
Oh, this is such a strange movie to try to rate, because I think it's the same problem that a lot of reviewers had when this movie first came out, is like having to mark a clear separation between condemning this movie versus condemning the original. Like, because it's so easy to come to the conclusion that if this movie is bad, the original must be bad because it's such an identical remake. But there's just so much lost in translation and lost in time that I think you have to say, like, it's not the original that's the problem. It's the few things that were changed make all the difference. That it's like practically all the same ingredients, but the way they're mixed together is wrong. And so for that, I'm going to say I didn't want to finish it. I don't want to watch it again. Ooh. I'm going to give it a 1. I like 1 Julian. And honestly, that's partly because of Julianne Moore too. Honestly, because she didn't have much to work with, but boy, this is one of her worst performances I think I've seen too. I didn't really find it very engaging. She had like 15 lines maybe. And I don't know, maybe there's just nothing she could have done, but I was disappointed.
Mm-hmm. Neil?
Yeah, I'm like going to mirror that exact sentiment. Unfortunately, I'm giving it also 1 Julian. Like kind of saying before, like, I don't think the movie tonally fits right. It just didn't work for me at all. And all of the characters, with an exception of like 2, were just didn't give it anything, in my opinion. Like, nothing. Like, Viggo Mortensen kind of put on an accent, I guess, but maybe not. I don't really know. And that's like it. Incredibly underwhelming. I'm sure the original Psycho, just groundbreaking as it is, like, is what I would prefer to go to if this was a movie I would watch, or this movie title is something I'd watch again. I'd just go the original.
Hey, there's the true conspiracy. Gus Van Sant made this movie bad on purpose, but he made it so identical that everyone who watches this one is like, well, that was so bad, now I have to watch the original. So he did that just to get people to be cultured and watch old movies.
Oh, thank you, Gus Van Sant, a true hero.
I mean, I'm gonna go watch the original now because I have to.
Yes. I hope the outcome of this movie is that you go watch the original, because I think it's a pretty incredible movie, and it's it has a great background too. But unfortunately, this movie was just. I mean, it was just looking through a peephole and masturbating. Like, it was not it was not good. Julianne Moore, I mean, she's Foxy in this movie. I think her wardrobe, whoever was in the wardrobe department, hit it out of the park. I can't wait for the next remake. She has these hilarious yellow headphones on when she enters in. And I can't wait until the next remake when they're like giant Beats headphones. But yeah, I'm going to give this 2 out of 5 because I did find enjoyment of it. I think it was a lot of it was just weird nostalgia. And she is fine in this movie, but it's also like, I mean, just look, even like looking at Jurassic Park, like, this movie, like, she is so far better than this movie. And it's just a shame that it's a shame that she did this movie and that it didn't give her anything that she deserves. So
I'll say to Julianne Moore what the psychiatrist says to her at the end. Sorry. Did you guys fucking catch that? Like, she's there in the police station, and he's like, sorry. And then he's like, and that's why, how Norman Bates sexualized this woman. And it just, like, just went on to, like, matter-of-factly describe how brutally she was murdered and how he's such a deviant, like, right in front of her after giving her, like, a one-word apology or, like, condolences for her sister's death.
Was that, like, right when he entered in? He just, like, turned to her and said sorry before he went on his monologue?
Yeah. He's like, oh, yeah, one of the family members is in the room. Better lay down for the law enforcement, like, every detail of the case with no, like, thought to protecting her.
Oh, the 60s.
Also, someone, one of the cops, I think, asked, like, if she's cold. Like, there was some weird exchanges in that final scene.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. I think we killed that movie and buried it in the lake, so I think we're good on that. Let's get to some recommendations, guys. Every episode, we end with some recommendations that don't necessarily have to be movie-related. So, Neil, why don't you send us off with your recommendation?
Yeah. So, my recommendation is a video game from 2013 for the PC. Mm. It is a top-down RTS strategy game called Company of Heroes 2. It's the sequel to the acclaimed Company of Heroes 1. And I don't know what your take on RTS games is in general, like Age of Empires or Command and Conquer games, but
big fan.
I'm a huge fan. I'm more of an Age of Empires Company Heroes person because it's a little bit smarter gameplay kind of a thing. But, like, so lately my brother does a Company Heroes 2 Twitch stream, and I've been joining him, and we've been trying to work up our competitive rank. And we got into the triple digits not too long ago.
Is there still an active community?
It's actually, surprisingly, it's got like the third highest active community base of all RTS games. So I think like Age of Empires 2, and I think a World of Warcraft game is above it. But this is like the next one in line.
World of Warcraft 3. And, Age of Empires.
Yeah, huh. Age of Empires 2 of all of them. It might be StarCraft 2, actually.
StarCraft.
Yeah, it's probably StarCraft.
Yeah.
But, like, Age of Empires 2 up there, StarCraft is up there. But, like, this is... I've been playing these games since they came out, and, like, it's based in, like, World War II, but it, like, does everything differently. So if you're used to something like Age of Empires, where it's, like, a four-resource, like, gathering type game, this, like, simplifies it a bit. And it's a little less base building, but it's way more tactically built. Like, things have cover. You can only, there's like smart, like, vision in it. So your units can only see, and they can't see over hedges and like, or like things like that. Like, it's built really well, and the engine on it is actually really well done. The company who did it is actually got the rights to do the next Age of Empires game. So Age of Empires 4 is actually being made by the Relic Entertainment with like the backing of Windows or whatever, or Microsoft, sorry. So I'm actually, that makes me really excited to see what Age of Empires 4 is going to be like. But this Company Heroes 2 game is just incredible, in my opinion. Like, they just had, I've been like addicted to it for like the past few months, just because like me and my brother have had like this whole like resurgence in it. And, but yeah, like to go with how you're saying about their community base, like they just had like a $10,000 2v2 tournament or whatever, like
what?
Not long ago.
Damn.
Yeah, like they are whole hog into this. Like, it's pretty incredible. And like, we've even played some of the top end players. Obviously we get stomped by them, but like, it's like, it's such an actually good tight knit community that's like very accepting and very fun to play with. Like, it's like the game does take a while to master, but it's not like, it doesn't have quite the learning curve as like an Age of Empires game would. But that's what I've been into lately, and I highly recommend it. It's pretty cheap on Steam at the moment, I believe. So if you're into like top down RTS games, this is definitely one to check out.
Cool.
Yeah, man. RTS games and fighting games seem to have those communities that just last for decades and are super tight-knit. Yeah.
Yeah. Would you like to plug your brother's Twitch stream?
Yeah, sure. It's a little bit bizarre, but it's Potter's mom. Don't ask me how we got the name, but it's the Twitch stream. He goes under Potter's underscore mom underscore. So cool. You can actually find him. He streams almost every weekday for the most part in the evenings, and I'm usually playing with him. So check it out.
Cool.
Yeah, man, Warcraft 3 is probably the reason why I'm a game developer.
Wow.
That game had one of the coolest custom game editors where you could practically do like a simplistic version of coding in the editor to like create your own game mechanics and crazy stuff. Like Warcraft 3 is where the MOBA genre started. Like actually you can trace back a ton of stuff to Warcraft 3. Tower defense games that started mm-hmm. with Warcraft 3 or thereabouts, you know, it was popularized by Warcraft 3. And stuff like Dota started there. So yeah, it's that has such a crazy history to the world of Warcraft before it ever was quote unquote the world of Warcraft. So yeah, that's really cool though that RTS games like that are still sticking around.
I'm really glad too. Yeah,
yeah, it's one of those genres that I loved back in the day because it was like one of those first games that felt really adult that I understood and tried to be good at. But then I just like I don't have the patience for it anymore. Like it's like all this actions per minute like garbage that it's just like I don't have the time to like train
Like that's why I kind of chose to go more towards this one because I've watched like top level play other RTS games and it's sickening how efficient you have to be.
Oh god,
sickening.
Yeah. it's sometimes it's like watching someone like do really quick work in a spreadsheet or something like
that.
You have no way of comprehending what's even happening. So it's like, it's just, yeah, just noise. But yeah, super impressive the people that can do it. And like, there are some games that I play to, I have enough knowledge of that I can watch something like that and that other people would never understand that I still enjoy. But yeah, that's I just can't do RTSs anymore.
Especially anyway. When games take an hour plus almost every single time. Like that's why it's hard to go with that route.
Yeah, for sure. Anyways, my recommendation is going to be a little on the lighter end, not gaming or movie or anything related. Really. It's just in the holiday spirit. I've took part every year for the last 6 years now in the Reddit Secret Santa. Have either of you guys ever done this before?
No,
I've never done it. No.
No. Okay. So Reddit Secret Santa is, I believe, the Guinness record holder for the largest game of Secret Santa.
Wow.
it's impressive. It's like over 10,000 people sign up every year, and it just keeps getting bigger every year. And there's this really interesting part of it that is not really it doesn't really apply to like your standard Secret Santa game, where usually when you do a Secret Santa it's like an office or with your family and you know the person pretty well that you're mm-hmm. end up getting a gift for. Mm-hmm. But with Reddit Secret Santa, it's just on the website, reddit.com, and you get another random user from the website who signed up that you have to buy a gift for. And the only thing you have to go off of to pick out a gift for them is they filled out a questionnaire, which is usually very, you know, sparse, not a lot learned from that. But you can also look at their Reddit profile and read through all their Reddit comments and read through, look at all the subreddits that they're subscribed to. And you get to try and figure out what's a random gift that they would like. And it's really fun. Unfortunately, it's too late this year, obviously. It's already been completed for 2018. But what I would say is go on to redditgifts.com and look at their other Secret Santas that they do. They have gift exchanges, they call them, almost all year round. They have like really low cost of entry ones too. Like, I mean, you don't have, there's not a minimum buy-in to like spend on your match, but they have like gift card exchanges and baked goods exchanges and stuff like that for random things throughout the year. Really, really cool stuff and an awesome community. This year I had the best match I've ever had. Since I'd been doing it for a few years now, I had a bunch of credits stored up where you can basically, once you've participated enough times successfully and they've seen that your shipment actually went through, you can get matched with someone else who also has that many credits. So I traded in 5 credits to be sure that I got matched with someone else who had participated to a high level of satisfaction of their gift receivers. And whoever the guy who got me this year, like, went way above and beyond, bought me the Betrayal Legacy game. And I know I recommended Pandemic Legacy on a past episode, so I'm like, just go look that up though. The Legacy board game format is incredible and I'm loving it, so I can't wait to play Betrayal Legacy. And he sent me, like, he's currently in the army stationed over in Korea, and he sent me some Korean candy and stuff. And it's just like the coolest thing ever. And honestly, the part that was even more impressive was that he bought both of my video games and like, oh, wow, told me how much he loved them and that he had a lot of fun playing them. And that is like the most meaningful gift I've gotten in all 6 years of doing this.
That's so awesome.
But I mean, honestly, the part of it that's fun is the giving part too. Like that is, it's so much fun to just try and find something that someone will enjoy, even if you're only spending, you know, $5-$10. Mm-hmm. So go check it out. Just go to redditgifts.com and sign up for whatever gift exchange is coming up, or you can wait till the next big one, which will be Secret Santa next year.
Cool. Very cool. I would like to recommend, I'd like to recommend a movie. I was very fortunate to go to a preview screening of Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse.
You jealous. Son of a bitch.
So damn jealous.
And I'm a guy who, I obviously grew up on Spider-Man. I'm a huge Spider-Man fan. But I've been really burnt out on Spider-Man in the past, like, 7 years. Like, you know, how many movies has there been? And, like, mm-hmm. some of them have been fine. Most of them have been pretty bad. But if you told me that Sony was releasing a Spider-Man movie in 2018, I would be like, no thanks.
Fool me once, shame on you.
So this is also an animated movie. And then Into the Spider-Verse, so the plot of it is, the Kingpin basically he makes a Hadron Collider, and he makes a rift in the space-time whatever, and he brings like 5 Spider-Men over to like the world that this movie takes place in. And so it's about 5 or it's about I think it's 5 different spider people, you know, joining forces to like defeat the Kingpin and then like get all those other like displaced spider people back to their own worlds. So it stars Miles Morales, who is like he's from like Ultimate Spider-Man, I think that's the comic book he's from.
Correct. Yeah.
And then it stars Peter Parker, who is the normal Spider-Man, and then Gwen Stacy as Spider-Woman, Spider-Man Noir, who's voiced by Nicolas Cage, then Penny Parker, who is a anime character who rides around in a giant mech, and then of course Peter Porker, who is Spider-Ham, Yep. So it's this team of all these spider people like joining forces, and it's, I mean, it is so fun. It's you know, the story is kind of on par with like all the other, like kind of what you would expect from a superhero movie, but the animation is some of the absolute best animation that I've ever seen. Like on par with like a Studio Ghibli movie. It is absolutely stunning from just a visual standpoint and a technical standpoint. It is absolutely just mouthwatering to watch this movie. And, you know, since, you know, like Penny Parker, she's an anime character. She is animated like a traditional anime character. And then Spider-Man Noir is black and white. And then Spider-Ham is, of course, he looks like a Looney Tunes character. And well, that all like should not work. Like meshing different animation styles like should not work. But it all works in this movie, and it's so incredible. I'm completely just blown away by this movie. And it's not just the animation; the acting is incredible. The music they use is stellar, and there's a Post Malone song who I don't know. Do you guys know who Post Malone is?
Yeah.
All right. I do not know anything about him, but he has a new song in this movie, and I've been listening to it nonstop since I saw this movie last week. So yeah, I hope this movie makes all the money, and they set it up for a sequel, as like all movies do, but I really hope they make a bunch of these movies, because it's just such a breath of fresh air to see.
I feel like studios should have been doing this a long time ago. Like,
yeah,
the obvious answer to the like Marvel live action films is not to just copy the Marvel live action films. Like, there have been the straight to video traditional animated films for DC and Marvel for a long time that have been relatively successful, you know, in just like pay-per-view or DVD sales. But giving it just a massive budget and doing a theatrical release seems like a no-brainer. And I am so ready to watch this movie, dude. It looks like exactly what we've been needing to like really mix up the theatrical superhero formula. Like, this is so different. It's such a breath of fresh air. I'm so excited.
Yeah.
It's the one thing that's,
and yeah, it could have,
sorry,
it could have easily, the budget could have easily been cut in half, and this could have been a straight to DVD. Like,
yeah,
you know, it feels like it's on that caliber of like all those DC movies, but right. I mean, they, you know, I think this is something that Sony is doing now, that they're just like, they basically threw in a white flag with live action Spider-Man movies. Mm-hmm. And that now they're just like, all right, but we really have to keep the license to this because it's all we got.
Well, do they not still technically have the license? Because they're just in like a partnership with Marvel for the Tom Holland Spider-Man movies. But those are still Sony movies, right?
Yeah, they're still making all the money from that. But yeah, they don't make them. I don't even know if they have much say in those movies.
I don't think they do, but it's just interesting that, I mean, they're still obviously benefiting from that substantially. So it's interesting to me that they had the foresight to do this and like evaluate that it wouldn't dilute the Spider-Man brand running simultaneously with the existing Marvel universe. So I'm not mad about that at all. Like, I really hope this does well. I hope it means that we get to see more unique animated superhero movies like this to complement the live action stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Me too. And Oh, and also, if you know kids, like, bring them, because this is this is a very kid-friendly movie. I think it's rated, it's rated PG. It does, it feels a lot like the, like, animated movies that we grew up on. Like, it's not, there's not a lot of, like, slapstick comedy. You know, and those, like, really, like, dumb, goofy jokes that I feel like a lot of kids' movies now are, but it also doesn't, it doesn't get dark. Like, it's not, it is not like a one of those weird kids' movies, or it's not like geared towards adults.
So tell me this, does it end in a song and dance number with the song written and performed by Justin Timberlake?
No, it does not. Good. No, it does not. Yeah. Sorry if that's a deal breaker for you, but
it is.
No, it does not. It also, I mean, no spoilers, but there is a moment in this movie that, like, my jaw dropped on the ground. Like, it was so shocking. And I was, like, very, I did not care much about this movie. So I didn't, it might have, I might have, like, not known it because I didn't watch any of the trailers. Mm-hmm. But, man, there is some storytelling in this movie that is pretty incredible.
Nice. I'll just have to, I'll have to make do while I finish out playing the PS4 Spider-Man game, because I'm still loving that shit.
Also, Liev Schreiber plays the voice of the Kingpin, or Wilson Fisk, and man, he is so good in this movie. Guy, he is an actor that is just so fun. He's just so fun to watch, like, even when it's just his voice. So
cool.
So hopefully by the time everyone's hearing this episode, this movie is still in theaters. If it doesn't win Best Animated Movie in the Oscars, I will probably not
riot
care,
in the streets.
I'm not gonna watch the Oscars. But man, it's like, yeah, riot in the streets. Like, it's such a shoo-in. Like, holy shit. All right, guys, that's been it for this episode of Credits Due. Thank you everyone for joining us and listening in. I hope you'll join us in 2 weeks for our next movie, where we'll be discussing Magnolia, diving back into a Paul Thomas Anderson movie. This is the only PTA movie I have not seen. So, so getting that bucket list checked off for this one. Looking forward to it, and I hope you'll join us. And until then, Tyler, how about you tell the people where they can get in touch with you?
You can find me on Twitter at Tyler Owen, and you can find the games that I make on my website, randomseedgames.com.
Hey, you can find me, Neil, on Twitter and Instagram at Dino Neil Man.
And you'll find me on Twitter and Instagram at Cron Master. That's C-R-O-G-H-A-N Master. I forgot how to spell my name. And you can follow the show on Twitter and Instagram as well at Credits Due Pod. And until the next episode, thank you for joining us, and remember, as always, I can handle a sick old woman.